This is session number 51, recorded on September 3rd, 2007. This is Side A, and we're continuing our exegesis or explanation of the Bob Dobbs formula chart. The subtitle of that chart is Coevolutionary Anticipatory Mimesis Equals How the Media Archetypes Fit the Battle of Jericho in American Politics. So the equation is two phenomena. Coevolutionary Anticipatory Mimesis, that whole process equals the process of how the media archetypes fit the Battle of Jericho in American politics. Now, we've done ALP, half of the stage, which is on the left of the chart, and in the far right column, HCE, the other half of the stage. Now, they're the stage structure, sort of like the invisible stage. You don't notice that. You're looking at the actors, and the actors are the kids, Shem, Sean, and Issy, who are defined as retrievals or interiorization. Interiorization was McLuhan's term for when a new environment is working on people and they don't see it, eventually they start to feel and notice the effects, and that's called the interiorization principle. So you notice the effects on previous media environments and what they're going through. And as you see these other older media environments dealing with new pressures and tensions or releases, then you know something is massaging them. So we know that the effects of ALP and HCE, the parents, are manifested in the actions of the kids. All right? The two twin sons, Shem and Sean, and the daughter, Issy. So we have the interaction between Shem, who is a technological slash cultural enemy, Sean is a technological slash weaponry, and Issy represents the particular culture or the established medium's sense of tradition. So it is the anthropomorphic sociological psychological mask slash lag. Lag because it's preserving what it thought it was in relation to something new that's contradicting it.
It's a conserving force.
It's a conserving force, yeah. And the moving ahead force, the probing force, is represented by the two sons. And so in the period of the telegraph, when the telegraph is going to be developed, but the developers don't know they're going to create a telegraph, so 100 years before, people are inventing or discovering interesting things around the concept of electricity, and as different little technologies are invented, they'll come together 100 years later by 1840, and you will have a telegraph invented. All right? So while that's going on, from 1750 to 1800, which is, in brackets, under HCE, the lockdown centralization process, you are seeing this manifesting of the telegraph in what's happening to the kids. And on the kid level, you see the new environment, technological weaponry, which is the manufacturers, taking on the older medium of usury and the British monarchy. So the American enterprise is starting to take off, and it's developing new industrial structures. It doesn't have to acknowledge the feudal regimes of Europe. But the feudal regimes get a little upset about this, and we end up having the American Revolution in the 1770s and 1780s, and a figurehead for that is General Washington. So that's why we have Washington there in 1776. So if you step down further, if you go down from movies on the far left and then to radio, you see telegraph. See to the right, telegraph?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you have under technological weaponry or Sean, oratory, and then the president is Lincoln, and the HCE column says 1840 to 1900, lockdown electrical government. All right? Now, telegraph.
Well, I want to get clear about something here on the previous level, because this applies actually to the whole chart. Why is usury slash monarchy, I understand that it's being invaded by the technological weaponry. The technological cultural enemy is being invaded by the technological weaponry. Is that correct?
Yes.
So why is usury slash monarchy? I could sort of see why it's technological, I guess, because it has to do with language, but...
And the printing press.
Oh, uh-huh.
Usury is printed money.
Yeah. And then why does that become the cultural enemy?
Right. Well, that's what I was leading into. And the way to explain this is if you notice two down from telegraph as the invisible environment, you see radio.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the invisible environment from 1840 to 1900. That is what is being thought about, though the thinkers and the inventors of little gadgets and aspects in the middle of the 19th century don't know that radio is going to be the product of what they're thinking of in 1855, 1875, 1895, right?
Mm-hmm.
So radio is like the teleological or final cause. But during this period, 1840 to 1900, when radio is invisibly the ground, you have an older environment, the telegraph, now representing the technological cultural enemy in battle against oratory.
Why are we calling it the cultural enemy? I don't get how culture feels that telegraph is an enemy.
Okay. Oratory, which is a verbal medium, has a problem with the discarnate nonverbal effect of the telegraph.
Mm.
So let's go back a step to illustrate this further. The printed book is an older medium, and it's up against newspaper, which is a more recent medium. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Technological weaponry. Manufacturers is sort of, they had manufacturers in Europe, so it's kind of an older medium, but it's up against another medium, usury and monarchy, which came from a long time ago.
Yeah, it's going to upset usury, and it's going to decentralize usury and monarchy. Manufacturers will.
Yeah, it's going to, manufacturers will create centralization. That's the assembly line and standardization. And it will upset the puny scale of social management that the medieval regime of monarchies represents.
Yeah, because you'll have thousands of manufacturers out there all fragmenting the power that the monarchy used to have.
Yeah, the manufacturers create new technology, which create new environments, which create new power fulcrums, and they upset the older media. So that's what the American Revolution was about. It was about the new manufacturing potential of America up against the visual space, printed book regime of the usury monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Now, during this period of time, I thought it was interesting that Adam Weishaupt founds the Bavarian Illuminati in May of 1776. Does that have anything to do with the effects we're looking at here? Why
that
would happen?
The idea of the Illuminati controlling banking and maybe a Freemasonic group conspiring to create a new world empire through controlling the banking, that's the image of usury and monarchy. So it's like an update of the usury monarchy image, but some people would say the kings were agents of the Illuminati, and that they were in a crisis of solidarity and continuing their 200-year monopoly in the new 18th century, which is 1750s on to 1800, that period of manufacturers which are creating new environments. So the Illuminati as an image surfaces because it's rearview mirror. It is the panic state or an attempt by the older environment of usury monarchy to maintain power as a result of the problems it's encountering. In other words,
so he would be on the side of the usury slash monarchy, whereas Adam Smith, who's also publishing Wealth of the Nation at the same time, would be on the side of the manufacturers.
Yeah, in general, yeah. LaRouche wouldn't agree with that, but in general, most people see Adam Smith as the beginning of understanding the new kind of economy that manufactured products were creating. And you see, lockdown centralization on the right side, 1750 to 1800, is going to be the effect of manufacturers, because manufacturers are an extension of visual space and standardization and kinetic space. But it will bring in a necessity of an educated population that at least has to have rudimentary literacy to work in the factories, or at least to manage the factories, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So the factory reality is starting to come in, and this is a threat to the old pre-factory world, which the Illuminati is kind of an afterimage of.
Right.
So we have to look at...
I think it's also worth pointing out that the Declaration of Independence is written in this period of 1776.
Well, that's the locking down of centralization. That's the fragmentary part of the Industrial Revolution, or Visual Space too, but the creating of a nation that separates from the central bank, visual space banking empire of Europe. But it has to centralize its own constituents within the nation to create a manufacturing economy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you get two aspects going on: decentralizing from the older environment of the printed book, and centralizing around the new industrial effects.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it means, locking down centralization. Centralization was starting 100 years before 1750, just beginning with literacy in the printed book. But now you're really going to consolidate it, and becomes a preferred way of operating. It's almost like a previous environment now becoming visible, so it's going to work because it's obsolete. And so you really do it, put all your social energies into it, because it's going to be obsolesced by the later phases, where you have locked down industrial government, locked down electrical government, locked down half-world government, locked down other half-world government. And that includes decentralization. So locking down centralization is the last gasp of centralization before you get into the telegraph era,
mm-hmm.
which is the electric age. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at the interactions of, let's take the next phase under television on the left column. You have movies in war with radio and telephone, and the stabilizing image, anthropomorphic human image that represents the stabilization of that battle is represented by Franklin D. Roosevelt. Okay?
Why is that?
Well,
he does the New Deal and introduces credit.
Welfare states. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the New Deal and unemployed insurance. So, now note I have on the far right, 1900 to 1918. Roosevelt isn't president until 32. So what we're showing here is that in actuality, 1900 to 1918, which is when the radio, known as the wireless, starts to surface. So it's a figure. It's the new technology, and it's upsetting the older environments, okay? But the real hidden ground for that period is television, which
sees. But radio doesn't come in until 1930, right?
No, radio comes in 1900, 1901.
Oh, okay.
That's when it's discovered. It's called the wireless. Marconi.
Well, when does it become environmental?
It becomes environmental in the 20s.
Yeah, and the telephone before that, right? And telephone is environmental before radio, is that right?
Yes. And this chart is showing processes way before what is normally recognized as when, say, radio became an environment. You might say radio became environment in the late 20s, early 30s. But we're talking about the effects and showing this chart. It's the anticipatory mimesis. Human consciousness is miming, anticipating the effects unwittingly of what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so that 1900, 1918, when radio was starting to surface, it first was sort of like a ham radio for people. And then the Easter Rebellion in 1916, these guys used the wireless telegraph and radio to do a broadcast.
Right.
But there were, like, I think it was in Toronto and then somewhere else, maybe in New York City, there were the first music show was like in the zeros or in the teens.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody started playing music and commentary and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But it was not many people are experiencing it, but it's happening in more populated areas.
Right.
One was in Canada, I can't remember his name, and the other one was, I think, in New York City. So it's beginning to be experienced by people. Now, they are probably thinking about it, or at least under the HCE, certain advanced informed intelligence agencies or academics or scientists are thinking about it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then science fiction is being written and is projecting ahead. But the point is that movies, which is in between television and radio and telephone, you know, on the television level,
mm-hmm.
movies is not television. Movies is not radio and telephone. Radio and telephone are simultaneous electric environments, which you would say are tribally communistic, because everybody can experience the same environment for free, and it's a discarnate state, right? Whereas
right.
movies aren't as discarnate.
Right.
Not even really discarnate. There's a slight electric component, but you go to a place and sit in a room and you travel. It's like an advanced version of the book. So you have a battle between the older movies and the newer radio and telephone, and when that battle's going on, television is sneaking up on everybody with totally different effects. So Roosevelt, under the mandate, the tribal mandate of radio, making everybody be in the same boat, and radio collapsed the economy in the late 20s, after it first was part of the electronic gadgets that created the boom of the 20s, but then it flips into a collapse. And we've talked about that in earlier parts of this.
Yeah, I actually was looking at this economist, Harry Dent. He has this thing called the S-curve, where he charts, as new technologies are developed, how they affect the stock market. And so he's, now you have automobile here on the next level, but the automobiles actually was already happening in the late 1800s.
No, probably, same time as movies,
1890s. Yeah, but 1890s, yeah, it was, and the automobile comes in before the radio. But he was saying, he was showing how you get the automobile, and then you get the production, you get the Ford assembly line, and that starts this S-curve slope going up in terms of the stock market going up. By the time you pile the radio onto that in the late 1920s, the S-curve goes up asymptotically, and then because everybody's shifting to the new medium, but then once,
the effects of the new media. Effect,
yeah, but then once the market gets saturated, everybody's got it, there's no place to go, and it crashes.
Right.
He says that's where we're at right now. We're at the last phase of the asymptotic S-curve slope with the internet,
digital.
The wireless, and the digital technology. He says it's going to crash in 2010. But in the meantime, we're watching the market go up pretty fast over
right.
the last couple of years.
Okay, so what you have here, Roosevelt, and this is within America. I mean, you've got Hitler and Churchill and Mussolini and Stalin, all these things going across the world. What do you have, Chiang Kai-shek in China? So you have these tribal emperors created by radio. So radio is creating a software communist tribal effect, and it's battling against the individualist technique, individualist star-making medium of movies. So the movies enhancing individual stars represents that old literate sensibility in conflict with the communistic group tribal effect of radio. Okay, and telephone. Many people back then, telephone was a party line, all right? The resolution of that battle, the stability, it's a rear-view mirror image. It's an attempt to put a human mask up there as someone's in control, right?
Right.
So Roosevelt comes in with a whole new program that's going to drastically alter the way Americans live. No longer this individualistic economy based on the private ownership of money. It's now a situation where the public owns the money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where everybody has access to paper money, what McLuhan called the poor man's credit card, where you are guaranteed some basic crumbs so that you don't starve, because you're living not on your farm anymore. You're living in cities and towns where you need to have access to cash to buy food, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Roosevelt is the image that resolves the conflict between the movie meme and the radio and telephone meme effect, though they're not really memes. The older medium tends to get the meme status first, all right, because it's no longer constituent and it becomes figure, so the effects that movies created when it was ground now are recognized as given, and people operate within that. So the meme level, that's like
meme
the idea
level
that,
is kind of archetypal.
Well, no, not yet, but it's when we say that environment
cliche.
Becomes shared and everybody is using it, and the rules of that situation are sort of understood.
Right.
That's where it kind of goes into human thought.
Cliche at that point, it works.
Yeah, and it probably affects the collective thinking consciously. So it creates a meme, right?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
What McLuhan used to call the law of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
He quoted that from some market advisor back in the 20s. That was a woman. I can't remember her name right now, but she coined the phrase the law of the situation, which McLuhan updated as the law of the medium. So here you have what's really going on in 1900 and 1918, 14, 15, 20 years before Roosevelt shows up, before the movies and radio and telephone have a battle, which is sort of going on in the 20s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Before all that happens, or is visible, there's actually something deeper going on that's going to show up later. And that's television. Television is the pushing of the envelope, the thinking that's going to create television, and the artifacts that are separately invented that will come together to create television is where the real hidden ground is happening. Just like we could say right now, the thinking and the products that will create cold fusion are being manifested and thought about and discussed and implemented on a very invisible level, but it's the true present. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, sure. Listen to these guys talk about quantum physics, and it's not mechanical anymore. We're in the frictionless realm, I think.
Well, you get into Jack Sarfati and the post-quantum physics, and the talk of dark energy and things like that. Dark energy, dark matter. It's like conceptualizing something that is really going to be an environment called cold fusion.
Mm-hmm.
So the interesting thing is, so when you have, so right now, as if the ground is cold fusion, what would be Shem and Sean? One of them would be the Harry Dent digital technology, and the other would be maybe satellite broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The last gasp of one-way broadcasting, or cable TV, or having your own computer.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the most advanced forms of digital technology would be under the Sean zone, and the less advanced, the older ones under Shem. All right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to come back to that, because that what I'm describing is actually on the chart.
Right.
You'll see it on the bottom column. You see where the blank horizontal little notches are?
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Right.
Okay. So going back now, so I've given an example of how to relate these factors. Let's look at the radio zone, where radio is the invisible environment. Who is the stabilizing, quote, feminine principle? It's not the feminine that AOP represents, but more like maybe the social stability that chemical body women represent. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The home and hearth and the idea that there's social order going on. I mean, that was the cliche back then. Save the women, save the children, right? The men go off to battle to protect the women and children.
Right.
There was an idea that they were the core of the society that must be protected, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a stabilizing image for that. There has to be an image that says, hey, we got this under control, you're all protected and everything's cool, right?
Mm.
So Lincoln, in the radio period, radio is the hidden ground under ALP, you had a battle between telegraph and oratory. Lincoln, the Gettysburg Address. You had famous orators in England and Europe. One of them was Disraeli, and another was Gladstone, in British politics at the same time as Lincoln, approximately. So you have here the verbal medium oratory is fighting against the telegraph effect. All right?
But oratory is not a new medium.
Right, no, it's not a new medium, but it is becoming prominent again because of the acoustic effect of the telegraph.
So we could say that in Marshall's tetrad that it's been retrieved.
Yeah. Before that, there was always oratory. But the point is that a lot of it was based on written statements. That's what newspapers were for, 1700. And before that, books. So the printed book, the eye, visual space stuff, is going into marginalization. So you bring back verbal oratory, and that's responding to the acoustic effect, the simultaneity of the telegraph. So one of the famous orators of that period is Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Right.
Now, what's going on in this Lincoln period, 1840 to 1900? Lockdown of electrical government. Now, Lincoln is trying to save the centralized situation, the Union against the Confederate States. So it's a rearview mirror situation that he's involved in, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to consolidate, protect the industrial government and the centralized government before that, the processes of 1750-1800 and 1800-1840, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's merging with the visible causes and visible effects and trying to preserve them. And so he uses oratory to fight against the effects of the telegraph. Now, the telegraph, McLuhan says that people still don't, other than the 70s used to say this, I don't know what they say now, but he would read the historians' comments on the American Civil War, and none of them knew what caused it. And so McLuhan said, well, the telegraph caused it, because the telegraph created a threat to the visual space organization of the nation. It also created the beginning of the electric decentralizing effect, and so the South felt it could secede. All right? So what you have here from 1840 to 1900 is not really, in the hidden ground part, a successful lockdown of industrial government or lockdown of centralization. You've got a lockdown of the electrical government, and the medium that it's going to manifest in is radio.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the intelligence agencies and political powers and administrators and bureaucrats trying to respond to a hidden ground, which they would see as oratory versus manufacturers, newspaper, usury, monarchy, whatever. They would not notice the telegraph.
Yeah.
So H.C. doesn't notice the telegraph, but it sees itself as using oratory to hold the world together. So that's the enemy. It's the weaponry used by the humans, but there's a technological aspect to it that's not recognized. And it's fighting against an enemy that it really doesn't fully understand, and that's under Shem, and that's the telegraph. It doesn't see the telegraph.
Right.
But from the perspective of our 2020 Hind vision, we can see what was really going on. Actually,
why doesn't it see the telegraph? The telegraph comes in 1844, so it's there this whole period, 1840 to 1900, this whole lockdown.
Yeah,
the telegraph is obviously part of everyone's awareness and daily
and
use.
And they're using it.
Yeah.
And usually the effects of it are not completely perceived, but they are responding to the effects of it. And so there is a problem with the South seceding. So they don't see it as a telegraph causing it, but what's going on is the figures of that. But from our perspective, looking back, it actually was the oratory, the Lincoln guys, were fighting against the telegraph.
How come the telegraph doesn't enhance the oratory? It allows...
Oh, it does. But oratory is verbal speech.
Mm-hmm.
The simultaneity of the telegraph environment moves us into the tactile.
Yeah.
Kind of a collective ESP. Now, where do you see evidence of that? You see that in the avant-garde arts. The artists and poets are starting to make new arts, which are considered bizarre, ugly, sinful. And this is represented by the Impressionists or Symbolist poetry. Baudelaire and Rimbaud and all kinds of things are going on in Europe. These are artists picking up and tuning into the hidden effects of the telegraph probably can't say they're picking up on radio, but they're starting to see something's going on that the politicians don't see. So the politicians are fighting and the generals are fighting the obvious effects of telegraph, but are not perceiving the cultural effects, the sensory effects, the more hidden effects. That's the job of the artist. And even they aren't recognized.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the great oratory artists of that period was Oscar Wilde, who would come up with these great pithy aphorisms, you know, and was known to have these witty responses to situations. And he would known as a person who would say these things.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So a figure like Oscar Wilde shows up in the 1880s, in this period of 1840 to 1900, and he's expressing and meeting a felt need for the aphoristic oral medium,
mm-hmm.
while other stuff is not recognized but is aware of Wilde as a popular figure and what happens in his life, but other people like Mallarmé are creating arts that are considered pretty strange.
Yeah. In the musical arts, though, I don't see the shift, because in the 1700s, we have...
Let me just give it quickly. You know who's the period 1840-1900? That's Wagner, his big tribal ecstasies.
Oh, we also have Beethoven, who doesn't seem like his sensibilities are all that different from Mozart.
Right, but that's the period before. So let's go back. I interrupted you. You wanted to go back to 1750-1800. That's Mozart.
Yeah.
Okay, and Bach, Handel, and Mozart. But maybe Handel's a little before that. But mainly Mozart is in this period, 1750-1800, okay?
Right.
The period of 1800-1840 is Beethoven.
Right.
Though Beethoven is before 1800 too, but he really peaks writing symphonies dedicated to Napoleon and then getting disillusioned with Napoleon, you know, when he becomes an emperor, those issues. So if you look at Mozart, what can we say about his music? Now, how does that resonate with the situation? They say Mozart was a member of the Freemasons and was interested in the American Revolution. He was up against, at least the movie that presents him, he's up against the Austrian, Hungarian, Venetian oligarchs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Represented that by that guy, I forget his name, who was the court composer who was
right.
making sure Mozart doesn't get too powerful, right?
Right.
So you could say that establishment composer was the usury monarchy faction, and Mozart, especially LaRouche would say this, was the inspirer and inspiration for manufacturer's sensibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you got Mozart there. The next level of movies, with the newspaper fighting the printed book. The printed book is
Let me just, let's see, movies we're going, okay. Just to wrap up the 19th century, let's just...
1840,
1900? Yeah, I'll just rattle off, because this is interesting, the people who emerge as being icons of the time. You got Monet... Beethoven, Charles Dickens, Mark Twain, Jane Austen,
Edgar, right?
Yeah, Edgar Allan Poe.
What are you looking at?
Wikipedia.
All right. So, what is the dates?
These would be the. This is the 19th century.
Okay, you're just looking at some inventory.
Yeah.
Do the names again.
Okay, so you got Monet, the Impressionist painter. Beethoven, who we just talked about.
It gives the dates of their lives?
Yeah, but I'm not going to try to parse that out. Charles Dickens, Mark Twain, 1894, Jane Austen, Edgar Allan Poe, Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche. So it's interesting just that group right there.
Yeah, they evoke a lot of... concepts that I could go into, but I don't know if I want to go into it now, but that would be the basically 1840 to 1900.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Beethoven's a little before that.
Yeah.
But it may be Jane Austen, but 1840 to 1900, you got Nietzsche, Darwin, Marx, Monet, Wagner, a lot of things going on. Now, note that look at what's happening to the image of nature. The great chain of being, which is the hierarchical image, is now collapsing before the Darwinian image, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you have Nietzsche representing the collapse of hierarchical visual space and the religions, waking up the Superman, who Nietzsche seems to be intuiting is the discarnate man.
Yeah.
And he's celebrating individual autonomy, which the electric age is starting to create the potential for. It's fragmenting out of centralized industrial governing and government. So, who else did you mention? And Wagner with his... he came up with the idea of synesthesia of the arts, or of mixed media. He had this vision that bring in music, painting, theater, and a symphony of the arts, multi-sensory kind of experience. So he's responding to the electric tactility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an invisible interplaying sense, but it makes you aware of the interplay of the visible senses.
Mm-hmm.
So his, and synesthesia is also a concept among the symbolist poets like Rimbaud and Mallarmé and Baudelaire. They come in with the idea of mixing the media, mixing the senses. So you're getting out of the emphasis on the eye and the visual sense,
mm-hmm.
which would be in the period of usury monarchy and manufacturers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so if we look at movies as the hidden ground on the left, and then the retrievals or figures or interiorization or actors, you've got newspaper and printed book and Jefferson. So Jefferson and these guys would be writing books. People would be enjoying the new potential to read books. And compulsory education is coming in, and they're up against the other visual medium of the newspaper, which is a medium that contains many book pages, has a little more collectivity in it. And that collectiveness leads to the idea of nation states and republicanism. In that period, what is not known, not noticed at all, but is being thought about is movies, cinema. And McLuhan writes about how the Romantic poets were, and Edgar Allan Poe was one of them, were devising techniques and means of writing that were cinematic. Dickens was, in retrospect, his techniques were cinematic. They were writing novels and using imaginative landscapes that actually materialized physically once cinema was invented. So a guy like Eisenstein, famous early Russian filmmaker, would read Dickens to get ideas for his movies.
Mm-hmm.
But Dickens was writing, you know, 60 years before him. And so that is an example of the artist picking up on effects of the hidden thought-about process, which is under ALP, the far left, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were thinking and creating books that were cinematic in their effect. And another aspect of the movies is they create epic visions. And so the newspaper is a more epical medium than the printed book.
Mm-hmm.
So the artist...
The movie, you know, the book, I thought it was interesting. I think it was Thompson. I was said that my numbers right, I think he said the first biography ever written was like only 200 years ago. So they had, before that they hadn't really actually, the individual hadn't been
a figure.
Yeah,
been consolidated by visual space.
Right, and now the movie carries on more so, I think, than other media. Sort of carries on the consolidation of the individual as a figure. I know sometimes, you know, I'll be affected by a movie. When I leave a movie, I'll be affected by a movie because I'll in some way, shape, or form feel like I've taken on the embodiment of the character, of the main character of the film. I'll walk out sort of feeling like that person, like I've absorbed something of their essence.
You've been miming them.
Yeah. I know when I, especially when I was an impressionable young teenager and I went to see my first, like, James Bond movie, you know, I would walk out of the theater feeling like I was like a 007 or something.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that it's not a psychological fault. Is that the young mind is becoming the medium and the image and the content, which is natural because the medium is massaging you. So you do become the figures.
Yeah.
You become the effect of the medium as a formal thing, but you don't see that. You perceive it. You just perceive the content.
Mm-hmm.
So the proof that the medium massaged your brain is the fact that you really think you're the content.
Yeah.
So you were saying about this, that why do you bring this up?
Just the
individualization of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's also because you're an American. The Westerner projects that into movies. Other cultures do movies interpreted differently.
Right.
You know, like McClone used to cite way back there in the 50s and 60s that in Asia and that, when movies were being projected, it was common for people to yell out and scream and interject.
Yeah.
But they couldn't do that in an American audience.
Yeah.
The American audience goes there for a private experience, a private dream.
Right. Kurosawa had his heroes in his films, but he, I think, heightened up more the landscape of than he did the individual. I'm not sure.
Yeah. When I think of a lot of those early Japanese movies, I think of, like, the group mind, little robots running around.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's not that way now, but back then, 50, 60 years ago, they were a more robotic kind of imagery.
Right. You had their archetypes, the samurai, the fool. The characters were very well defined.
Stock cliches.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a little odd to the subtleties of individuation that Westerners wanted in their characters.
Yeah.
So the distinction between cultural enemy and weaponry, let me explain that. Weaponry is a technology that you think will preserve the status quo. And it's up against another technology which represents a threat to the status quo. Now, the status quo is the sensory biases and cultural preferences that a medium has conditioned the population to experience and feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, when movies are really the ground, and nobody knows it, but they're coming, and they're going to upset the consequences of the battle between printed book and newspaper, that in a sense, whoever wins that battle will quickly lose because some other situation is sneaking up on them, and it's going to change the rules again.
Right.
And that's movies. So if you think of children as very sensitive, they say, to what's going on between the parents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Any tension or whatever's going on between the parents, the kids feel it and start acting out whatever the stresses are, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the movie, in the phase of movies, or any of the phases on the left-hand side, the tension between what is coming, that hidden movie effect, the tension between that and the intelligence agencies or the bureaucrats or the administrators of social stability and power, they're picking up something's going on, something new is changing, because this is over the last 250 years, which is the first time in history people had so many different environments coming on them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the powers that be are intuiting something going on, and so they end up having a struggle, a fight, a battle over power, and they think it's the content of printed book and newspaper. They don't know it's the printed book and newspaper as form, and that those two forms are responding to a new form that's sneaking up.
Yeah.
So all those names that you listed, 1800, 1840, 1849, 1900, the 19th century names, they would be represent figures for different media that are involved in heated cultural exchange and cultural stabilization, cultural inspiration, cultural rebellion. Those artistic scientific figures are part of what we have here as the kid level.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a chart of the media forms themselves.
Yeah.
So I have Jefferson as anthropomorphic because the only human in this chart is what's listed under Issy, right?
Right.
And that human is really not exactly a chemical body human in effect. It is an image that responds to the battle between Shem and Sean, which is a battle picking up on the tensions between ALP and HCE.
Yeah.
So...
And, you know, probably in a very fundamental way, we could relate all this back to McLuhan's idea of the ratio among the senses.
Ratio among ratios of proportions, yeah.
Ratio of among proportions of the senses.
Yeah.
So these are all, because each new technology is shifting the sensory ratios.
Yeah.
And once we become comfortable with our sensory ratios, once the environment, the technology becomes cliche and then archetypal, then a new media form comes in.
Upsetting the sensory given.
It wants to reshuffle our the proportions among ratios among our senses.
Yeah.
And that is very upsetting because it's literally, it's like dying because your whole identity is being moved around.
The familiar is being threatened.
Yeah.
Now, McLuhan emphasizes the senses. I'm emphasizing the problems and battles between the media forms themselves.
Yeah, as though they were like objective entities, like gods on Mount Olympus or something.
So the cultural enemy is something that's seen as foreign to what is under the weaponry. So in the United States...
Hold that thought, and I just want to say. So the deep unconscious level is the one-half stage bottom-up ground effects preceding causes. That hasn't even come into manifestation yet, but it's casting its effects on the anthropomorphic, sociological, psychological mask lag, the present human consensus world. And then the technological cultural enemy is actually present in the environment, but its effects aren't really noticed because everyone's still pretty much focused on the people and the category of the technological weaponry, and they're using that technological weaponry as a way to resist the effects of the new environment and the coming new environment,
or the older environment.
The older environment.
Well, usurian monarchy was around before manufacturers, as we use the term manufacturer. Manufacture was the term for industrial products in the 1700s, early 1800s. That's what Alexander Hamilton and them would say when they were discussing growth in the society.
Yeah.
We need more manufacturers. That would be ending in R-E, not E-R-S.
I guess that's a...
I
guess that's a point of confusion for me, because usury and monarchy is an older medium than manufacturers, but telegraph is a newer medium than oratory.
Right. It doesn't make sense there on the surface.
Newspaper is a newer medium than printed book. It's the newer media coming in. And matter of fact, it looks like maybe the only category... Well, no, it looks like this thing flips around, but... Because usury and monarchy is older than manufacturers... television is, but everything else under cultural enemy is the newer technology.
That's right, and most of the ones under weaponry are older, but not every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. I mean, you're eventually to know, once you get familiar with the chart, you're to notice that, like you've done, and raise the question. The reason usury and monarchy are under what you would call the newer things. So let's just go through that.
Okay, I think we need to take a break.
Okay.
And we'll pick this up.
Okay, good.
Okay.